The Christian life is one, just in case you didn't know, and you're not, if you're not a Christian, the Christian life is one filled with ups and downs. I have a great pleasure and privilege of standing here a minute ago telling you about some of the opportunities that we have. But in my Christian life, in my own life, those moments of opportunity come with great challenge. And it's important, I think, sometimes when I get up to speak and do sermons, it's important that, not that I air everything, but I am tired. And it has been a challenging summer in lots of different ways. There's been lots of spiritual attacks, and there's been lots of great stuff as well. And I can sometimes, one of my weaknesses is that I can stand here and appear kind of bulletproof and appear really kind of, you know, confident and that this is easy. And I guess for some people who are struggling, that's maybe not always helpful. But the Christian life is one of real challenge and an amazing opportunity. And that's actually the normal pattern. That's the pattern as it was for the church in Acts. That's how Luke writes the story. He has these great opportunities for the church, and then at the same time, there's great challenge and hardship. And you see the opportunities, great things happening. Thousands, Peter preaches his first sermon, and thousands of people declare, Jesus is my Lord. And then we have Ethiopian eunuchs saying, Jesus is my Lord. And then we have Cornelius, and we have Saul, and we've got Samaritans, and we've got Gentiles coming and declaring, Jesus is my Lord. Great opportunities grasped. And in chapter 13, we're going to read chapter 12, but in chapter 13, there are more opportunities. People are going to take the gospel to the whole world. Two guys are going to take it out to the whole world. What an opportunity. But first comes the challenge. And it's dead easy to miss. Read over Acts chapter 12. It's dead easy to miss. This is a crisis for the church. Let's read these words. It's a real crisis for the church. Acts chapter 12, verses 1 to 19. Let's read them together. About that time, King Herod Agrippa began to persecute some believers in the church. He had the apostle James, John's brother, killed with a sword. When Herod saw how much this pleased the Jewish people, he also arrested Peter. This took place during the Passover celebration. Then he imprisoned him, placing him under the guard of four squads of four soldiers each. Herod intended to bring Peter out for public trial after the Passover. But while Peter was in prison, the church prayed earnestly for him. The night before Peter was to be placed on trial, he was asleep, fastened with two chains between two soldiers. Others stood guard at the prison gate. Suddenly, there was a bright light in the cell, and an angel of the Lord stood before Peter. The angel struck him on the side to waken him and said, "Quick, get up." And the chains fell off his wrists. Then the angel told him, "Get dressed. Put on your sandals," and he did. "Now put on your coat and follow me," the angel ordered. So Peter left the cell following the angel, but all the time he thought it was a vision. He didn't realize it was actually happening. They passed the first and second guard posts and came to the iron gate leading to the city, and this opened for them all by itself. We're used in our modern age, the doors opening by themselves. Do you understand how weird that is? You know, you walk into Tesco's and the doors open by, as if by magic. But they didn't do, believe it or not, they didn't do that in ancient Rome. I've lost my place. So they passed, the gate opened all by itself. So they passed through and started walking down the street, and then the angel suddenly left them. Peter finally came to his senses. It's really true, he said. The Lord has sent his angel and saved me from Herod and from what the Jewish leaders had planned to do to me. When he realized this, he went to the home of Mary, the mother of John Mark, where many were gathered for prayer. He knocked at the door in the gate, and a servant girl named Rhoda came to open it. When she recognized Peter's voice, she was so excited that instead of opening the door, she ran back inside and told everyone, "Peter's standing at the door. You're out of your mind." They said, when she insisted, they decided, well, it must be his angel. Meanwhile, Peter continued knocking, and when they finally opened the door and saw him, they were amazed. He motioned for them to quiet down and told them how the Lord had led him out of prison. "Tell James and the other brothers what happened," he said, and then he went to another place. At dawn, there was a great commotion among the soldiers about what had happened to Peter. Herod Agrippa ordered a thorough search for him. When he couldn't be found, Herod interrogated the guards and sentenced them to death. Afterward, he left Judea to stay in Caesarea for a while. James, the James at the start of that reading, James was one of the leaders of the church. And he's killed. By the sword means, by the way, beheaded for his faith. Now, people had died before in the church. Stephen had died. You read about that in Acts chapter 6 and 7. But this is James. This is James, one of the inner circle of Jesus' friends. Not just a disciple and an apostle, but in the three that are closest, that are right in closest to Jesus. It was Peter and James and John who saw Jesus raise a little girl from the dead. It was Peter and James and John who went one day with Jesus on a mountain, and they got this glimpse of glory of who Jesus really was. Mark chapter 9. When Jesus is in the biggest crisis of his life on earth, and he's in a garden and he's praying, it is Peter and it's James and it's John who are there on the night before he was killed. And James wasn't old. He could have given so much more. He could have done so much more. Think of the things that James could have done. The people that he could have influenced and spoken to and preached the gospel to. But he's dead. It's absolutely pointless, isn't it? What a waste. So many years ago, there was a group of young missionaries. And they were so convinced, they were all professional guys, and they were absolutely convinced of their call to go and preach the gospel to a group of Indians in the Amazon. And so they planned and they gave up their lucrative careers, and they planned and they worked and they moved. And they finally reached this tribe, this remote tribe. And on the day they arrived, they were murdered. Now, as it happens, their wives continued their mission, and actually reached them for Christ, the people who had murdered their husbands. But that is what Jim Elliot, who was one of those men, said. He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to to gain what he cannot lose. This life is not all there is, and our priorities are not what God's priorities are all the time. We don't see it from God's perspective. And the truth is that it's always been that way for the people of God. Hebrews 11, you can go and read the end of Hebrews 11. The great heroes of the Christian faith, sawn in two, heads chopped off. Becoming a Christian might be seriously damaging to your health. And Jesus promised us. He promised us that it would be that way. When he said in Mark chapter 8, he said, if any of you want to be my follower, give up your own way, take up your cross, and follow me. If you try to hang on to your life, you will lose it. Young people up on the balcony there, and if you're young downstairs too, our culture tells you, hang on to your life. Make as best you can all the plans. Jesus said, if you try to hang on to your life, you'll lose it. But if you give up your life for my sake, you will save it. And what would it benefit you if you gained the whole world but lost your own soul? For James, that meant losing his life, killed by the sword. For Peter, by the way, not for the first time, I think for the third time, it means he's in prison. Right? For this new Christian church, one senior leader is dead, and Peter is in prison, and the only reason he's not dead is because it's the Passover, the Jewish Passover, and you can't kill people during the Passover. So he's alive until the Passover finishes, then Herod's going to bring him out, kill him, because that'll make the Jewish people happy. This is a crisis. It was all going so well. But now the opportunity's lost. So faced with a challenge, with a crisis, well, what did the church do? Well, Acts 12, verse 5 says, well, while Peter was in prison, the church prayed very earnestly for him. The church got together and they prayed. That word earnestly prayed, by the way, is the same word that is used to describe Jesus when he prays the night before he dies. Do you know, I was in another church on Friday night, church in Troon, and it reminded me they still have the pews. And on the pews, they have there's a little thing that sits right down here. And in some churches, they even have the cushion. Right? And that's because, genuinely, people were on their knees in prayer. Let me ask you, are you on your knees in prayer? Much easier to be humble when you're on your knees in prayer. And the reality of this story is, you see, there's two forces who are pitted against one another. There's an overwhelming might of Rome and the power of Herod the king, and he's got all the power and everything is just in his favor, and it's all there and it's all inevitable. And they are in an unbeatable position because they've got Peter banged to rights. He's sealed up in prison. And all the mechanics of the machine and the government are behind them. And do you know something? When I wake up of a morning and I turn on my TV and I look at the parliament and I look at BBC News and so on, and I look at the messages that they put out, the whole mechanics of our culture are against us. I don't mean that they're persecuting, but they're putting out a message that is not our message. Two sides. And on the other side, you've got the church. How pitiful do they look? In a little house, praying. That's the battle between the world and the church, replayed many, many times down the years. But this, that what possible good could praying make? And sure, let me tell you, it ain't like God saved James. So James is dead. It's not like they weren't praying for James. The church were praying for James, and he died. So what good does prayer do? But you see, no matter what it looked like, and no matter what it looks like in our day, see, in the world terms, it looks like it's not a fair fight. Well, it isn't a fair fight, but not the way you think. Because you see, these people are praying to the God of all creation. God who can do anything. It really isn't a fair fight. Now, we're in a season as a church. We're not in a season of crisis, right? And given what I said at the start, please don't think that I'm going to fall over and run away and all that kind of stuff. I'm not in that space. I'm not in that place. I'm just tired. But we have challenges and we have opportunities. The challenges that face us just in Troon are immense, right? I was at a dinner last night, right? When challenges in your community, challenges in the country, 1.5 million people destitute in the United Kingdom. 1.5 million people destitute. And I got to tell you, Troon, I meet some of them. One in four children in poverty. We had an MSP last night, an MSP stand up and say that the church is the answer, the only answer to some of those social problems. And that's just talking about the material reality of people's lives. Less than 1% of people in this country would declare themselves to have any kind of meaningful Christian faith. We are an unreached people group. And we are small and we're insignificant in number. And there are more people in restaurants right now within 200 yards of this place than there are in here right now. And you know something, let me tell you, I'm preaching Revelation. Come hear that. Come hear Revelation in the evening. Because let me tell you, that is a crisis for the people out there. Because they're going to a lost eternity. People talk about what Revelation means. And on the one hand, it shows the glory of God. And then it shows that judgment is coming. And with the challenge comes opportunity. So what will we do? We're going to ply on in our own strength. I've got to tell you, it hasn't worked well. Or will we pick up earnestly the one neglected weapon we have that will change everything? Prayer. Listen to this from Revelation 5, verse 8. When Jesus took the scroll, or when he took the scroll, the four living beings and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb. This is in the throne room of heaven. Each one had a harp, and they held gold bowls filled with incense, which are the prayers of God's people. Your prayers are actually in the throne room of God. And listen, if you come tonight, you'll see this amazing picture of the might and the power and the glory of God, the ultimate reality. That's ultimate reality. And we have access day and night, anytime, into that throne room. J.C. Ryle was a minister, a wonderful minister. There's a fantastic book called Do You Pray? That he wrote, actually, in the 1800s. This is what he said. We have an intercessor, Jesus Christ, who will speak on our behalf. It is Jesus Christ who's waiting to present our prayer if we will only ask him to. He takes our feeble prayers and his own almighty prayers so that they go to the throne of God as a sweet aroma. Think of a bank check without... For those of you on the balcony, a check, by the way, that's what we did before we had kind of like plastic cards that you tapped on things, right? Think of a bank check. Without the proper signature, it is worthless. It is the signature that gives it great value. Similarly, the prayers of a believer are feeble and weak until they are in the hand of the Lord Jesus. Once there, they have great value and achieve great things. It is prayer that made them strong in Acts 12. It's prayer that makes us strong. Are we praying enough? Now, this is where it gets real. It gets real. Because I got to tell you that the evidence of our gathered prayer meetings would say no. You say, okay, I can't make a Thursday night. Okay. Then arrange another night. Gather people with you on that night. You can't get up out of your bed at 7 a.m. on a Friday morning. Okay, you can't get up out of bed. Not everybody can do that. That's fine. Well, then organize another morning. So we can get on our knees as a group of people and we can be praying for the things that David asked us to pray for. That we can be praying as a church, that we would reach out into our community, that we'd be a people who are doing that. And listen, it might take some time. Charles Spurgeon, the great, great preacher, Charles Spurgeon said, some mercies of God are like blessings which, like ripe fruit, drop into your hand the moment you touch the branch. So as soon as I pray, there's a kind of blessing that kind of falls, right? That's what he's saying. But there are other blessings which require you to shake the tree again and again. And that is what the church did in Acts. Faced with crisis and opportunity, they prayed. And on October the 4th, right, from the morning of the Friday morning prayer meeting, 7 a.m., there's going to be prayer in this church all the way through 24 hours, round to Saturday at 8 a.m. And yes, I know that's 25 hours. Right? Do you know some of the sweetest times I've had in this church is praying with people at 2 a.m. in the morning? But every time Ali and the guys go out to organize it, they have to badger and they have to push. They have to cajole people to come and pray. I'll leave it with you. So they prayed. So what did God do? Well, from the earnest prayers of the church, the focus switches to inside the prison where Peter is held. And Peter has escaped from prison before, mind you. So he has got out of jail before. So they've doubled the guard. They have two guys handcuffed to him, right? Just to make sure that he can't get out, right? And you would think, now you would think, and I would be a little bit stressed because tomorrow morning, I die tomorrow morning, right? And what do we find Peter doing? Fast asleep. Sleeping like a baby. Although actually, I think that phrase should change, frankly. Experience of my own children. He was actually sleeping. Deep, deep sleep. In fact, the angel, you read it again, the angel has to come and kind of nudge, slap him awake. That's incredible, right? In Philippians 4, verse 6, Paul, not Peter, but Paul would write this, don't worry about anything. Instead, pray about everything. Tell God what you need. Thank him for what he has done. Then you will experience God's peace, which exceeds anything we can understand. Here it is, in action. Going to be killed in the morning. I'll have a wee sleep. Now, I think of where Peter is. When I think of that, I kind of think of the mission Impossible theme tune kind of starts going off in my head. You know, you've got ideas. So your mission, Peter, should you choose to accept it, is to get out of that cell scot-free. Peter would say, no chance. Nay chance, if you want the Scottish version of that. And then I think, your mission, God, should you choose to accept it, God of all creation, the one who made the heavens and the earth, the one who is eternal, the one who controls the whole cosmos, the one who sees the end from the beginning. Your mission is to get Peter out of that cell. No problem. No problem. There have been earnest prayers said, can God deliver? Oh, yes. And yes, we really do believe in angels. They're not the norm. But here's an angel who comes, and really, this isn't a fair fight at all. Herod and all his armies and all his guards did not stand a chance. You know, that we could see that. I pray that we could understand ultimate reality. There was a man in the Old Testament with Elisha. And Elisha stood in the city and they're surrounded by the army coming to get them. And Elisha just simply prays. Open his eyes, God. And the whole heavenly host appears. So Peter is miraculously released from prison. He heads straight to the base of the church at Mary's house. Notice, by the way, they're praying. It's the middle of the night, but they're praying. And then there's this lovely little girl, Rhoda. Don't you love that she gets named? Don't you? Rhoda. And she's dead excited. In fact, she's so excited she forgets to open the door. And look at that. Here's an interesting thing, because the people are praying. But they don't believe that God's really going to answer. Now, I stand here most Sundays. Maybe not every Sunday, but I stand here most Sundays. And I finish my sermon, or finish the benediction, with the words from Ephesians 3:20. You can't not have noticed that. Unless you're really asleep a lot. Right? This is what it says. Now, all glory to God, who is able through his mighty power at work with us to accomplish infinitely more than we might think or ask. But we don't really believe it. They didn't really believe it. so often surprised when God does anything. Peter is rescued. The church rejoices. God is glorified. But as we finish this morning, I want us to see one little thing. I want us to look back and see what God didn't do. Because all of this sounds awfully familiar to me when I read it. Here is Peter imprisoned during Passover, and he's rescued by God. There was another man who was arrested, beaten, crucified, and killed. The one who actually is on the throne. The one who created, surrendered to creation. The one who was eternal, surrendered to death. And there was no rescue. Oh, there could have been. But there wasn't. There was no miraculous escape. Why? Well, you see, Jesus Christ, he did it for us. He did it for you so that you can be free. He didn't have to go through all that. He was God. And you know something, actually, that picture of how Peter's rescued, it is a picture of how we become Christians. Peter was chained up, condemned to die, and no hope of rescue. So are we. I've been a Christian for 34 years. Sometimes, you know, I can't really understand how people can't see. I don't really understand how people don't get it. But you know why? It's because when I was 8 years old, and yes, I know that means you can date me. When I was 8 years old, the light flooded into the darkness. And once the light's there, you see the path is so obvious, so clear. What a God that we worship. What a God we worship. And my prayer is that even the most faraway sinner, even the most awful person, dare I say it, even the most religious person, and you've been in church for years, but you have no idea what I'm talking about. No idea about the peace or the light or the joy or the love. We have a God who surrendered to sin and to death so that we do not have to. He really does do more than we ask or imagine. I'm going to ask the band to come back. And the words of the song that we're going to sing, I'll finish with these. You'll sing them in a minute. But in Christ alone, who took on flesh, fullness of God and helpless babe, this gift of love and righteousness, scorned by the ones he came to save, till on that cross, as Jesus died, the wrath of God was satisfied. Every sin was laid on him. Here in the death of Christ, I live.